Hello and welcome to episode 5 of season 3 of the Poolside Pass podcast. On today's episode, I'm going to be speaking with Swim Ireland head coach Ben Higson about his experiences working with senior athletes during his career. Before we jump into the interview with Ben, here's a quick line from our sponsors, Streamlined. Become a qualified swimming teacher with Streamlined in as little as 6 days. Learn at your own pace and be guided by our expert tutors. You can do your training face-to-face, online in real-time, or a combination of the two. Assessment can be in your club using videos or attending one of our assessment venues. We offer tailored, high-quality support. Quote the Poolside Pass for an extra 10% discount. Okay, so I think it's about time I introduced Ben. Ben, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, and thanks very much for having me on.
Oh, no, you're very welcome. Why don't we just start with getting a background of you within the sport of swimming and how you got into coaching?
Yeah, I was, like many coaches, I was a swimmer. And I swam through till my very early 20s, late teens. Always kind of had a idea that I wanted to coach at some level. Wasn't sure whether it would be a career or a hobby. And was lucky to be offered a coaching job in the southwest of Scotland, which originally started as just as a relief coach while their head coach was off. It was meant to be for 12 weeks. It transpired into 3 years. And from there on, I moved to Stirling or back to Stirling to coach and then ended up so far in Ireland. So it's been a bit of a whirlwind of a journey so far. But my background is swimming-based, sport-based. My full family are very sporty. Even now with my parents, they still exercise. My mum's a very keen marathon runner, even in her 60s. So I'm not going to take up that pastime anytime soon, but I'll leave that to her. But yeah, that's the background. It's swimming-based, and I went to university and studied sports science and didn't really have a clue what I wanted to do when I was at university in terms of with the degree, but I always knew that I wanted to coach at some level, whether that was, like I said, as a hobby or as a full-time job.
So you mentioned there you started out as like almost a relief coach and then kind of got thrown into that role for 3 years and then went to Stirling and now you're at Ireland. Your career trajectory has been quite steep and probably one of the youngest head coaches of a nation, certainly that I'm aware of. How was that journey for you? And, you know, was it something that was planned or you've just kind of been thrown into these kind of positions?
I mean, like I said, I always wanted to coach. I made sure that I had the relevant qualifications. That's first tick in the box, if you like. And obviously, they're a great learning tool as well when you're starting off. But all my experience when I took the job in Dumfries was from being a swimmer. Very, very, if any, was from coaching. So I was really going into that first job where I was predominantly, well, I was coaching all age group kids. It was a club of 100 swimmers, and all the knowledge I had was from past coaches that had coached me and from my own swimming itself. So from a coaching perspective, I was very, very green and relied on my own knowledge of when I was a swimmer. The trajectory probably wasn't planned. It's been quite steep, and there's certain jobs along the way that I always wish that I could do. For example, the Stirling job, when that opportunity came about, that was only meant to be a year secondment from my job in Dumfries during the 2013-2014 Commonwealth Games season. I was going in there to assist Rob Greenwood with the Stirling athletes. And Rob then obviously moved on to British Para in September 2013. I was lucky enough to be able to lead that program, and through that first year in Stirling, I was heavily supported by a lot of people in Scottish swimming, a lot of coaching peers, and British swimming as well. So I'm very grateful for the support I received in that period. But it's not something that was planned, in terms of this was in 2013 I would like to be in Stirling. It was very much take my opportunities when they come along, and similar to the job that I'm in at the moment, the island job, it wasn't planned. It wasn't something that was on the radar. And it was an opportunity, and I thought, you know, grasp it with two hands, and if it doesn't go well, then, you know, go back and do what I was doing before, which is coaching at club level, which is, you know, regardless of where I'm coaching, I'm happy just to be on deck, wherever that is.
Cool. So you spoke there about how obviously the trajectory wasn't so much planned. One thing that I've noted from your Twitter is that as a coach, you tend to be very well planned in what you do. I've seen some of your screenshots from your planning. Obviously, in the situation we're in now, preparing hopefully for the Tokyo Games in the summer 2021, but also into that typical 4-year cycle for 2024, how are you managing? Is it a case of we're just focusing on Tokyo at the minute, or have you got kind of half a thought on thinking about 2024 as well?
No, I think when we first entered into the lockdown period, which was March now, you know, March 2020, it was almost, you know, the games hadn't quite been postponed straight away. So the kind of feeling was, we gave everybody maybe 10 days off. And I know everybody was in their own houses and very much under curfew, but give everyone a period of time off just to reflect and to kind of almost just kind of get their head straight. And I don't want to say the word mourn, but, you know, it was quite traumatic for a lot of people. Yeah. And still now, I know that we're back in another lockdown, but, you know, there was a lot of athletes that were panicking and worried about losing fitness. And I thought just a 10-day break to kind of reset was what we needed. And then obviously we started training again via Zoom links and things, still planning for Tokyo. But obviously when that was postponed, I think we made a decision to, you know, keep one eye on Tokyo, like you've said there, for 2021. And then also, you know, start to significantly plan through to 2024. Because as we already know, that cycle has started. And before you know it, we're going to be a year into that cycle by the time the last swim happens, hopefully in Tokyo in the summer. So, you know, 3 years isn't a long time from that period. And it's actually only two and two-thirds until the next Olympic trials, even though we've not had this one yet. So yeah, you've always got to be planning and evolving, because the sport doesn't stop for anything. And, you know, I think along this journey, with decisions between FINA and Len, there's going to be a condensed calendar across the next 18 months. You know, I think I'd worked out from May 2021 through to July or August 2022. There's something like 6 or 7 international swim meets between long course and short course. So,
oh, wow.
You know, there's a busy period for athletes, and we have to ensure that the ones targeting Tokyo are ready and are best prepared as they can be, and the ones that are obviously on the radar for 2024 are not lost to the sport through the situation we're in at the moment. So it's a fine balance of ensuring that the athletes of the now or today are getting what they need, and the athletes for 3.5 years time are going to be prepared enough to deliver results.
Cool. So I guess when you was also speaking about kind of how you now set up your kind of program in terms of how you go about your coaching, when you was at Stirling, was that kind of the first time you came across using the Olbrich model, or is it something you've been using before that?
No, I think it was sometime in 2012. I was still coaching in Dumfries, and there was a presentation with Jan Olbrich that I either attended or I read online, and I was familiar with it, just like you're familiar with all sorts of training models in swimming. And you know, there was as a young coach, there was bits of all models that you try and you look at and you read, and they're the new, not the new craze, but you think, can I add and can I make an addition to my training plan with bits of this model and bits of that model? And it wasn't until September 2013 when I moved into Stirling, you know, Rob Greenwood and Ian Wright had already established the model there, and we're running it with the athletes. So obviously I was going to be Rob's understudy, and they were using that model. So even when he decided that he was moving into the British para role, I just continued with the model, and it was very much a hands-on learning, and a very much a quick and steep learning curve with the model. But I think it brings balance to the training, environment. I think it brings a great understanding to the athletes. They have an understanding of why they're doing what they're doing at certain times. So it brings a sense of calm across a training week and across a mesocycle. And I think you can sit and you can listen to presentations from Jan and his wife Pascal, and you can sit and listen to other coaches talk about how they use the model. And my biggest bit of advice is, if you're interested in it, try it for a period of or a season or two seasons and see if you like it, because it's very much hands-on learning, and from my personal opinion. And I really, really enjoy it, because it quantifies why we've done something, what we need to do next, and whether and where someone needs to be. You know, I think when we're working with senior athletes and age group athletes, but specifically senior athletes, you know, we have their careers are at stake. So for me, playing a guessing game is not something I wish to do, and that's not a disregard to any other training model, because there's some fantastic results come from all sorts of varieties of training. But for me, this quantifies where somebody is physiologically at a certain time, and allows me to plan and prepare for the future, which I think is important when you're talking about athletes that are maybe in their last 1 or 2 years of their swimming career. And, you know, we've got to make sure we're getting things absolutely right.
So within this model, then, when you're looking at like setting up your week of training, how do you go about doing that? Do you have typically, you know, a week that is a pretty standard week, and then you just tweak it week to week, or is it like a brand new structure to the week every week?
Yeah, well, I think I always try and be at times progressive, purposely regressive through a mesocycle. So we'll conduct an Albrecht test, usually after a recovery week, so they're at the freshest point. We always do ours on a Monday evening, because we have long course and that's when it fits best. And then once we have the results, when we're planning the week, regardless of the individual's needs, we will always try and fit specific sets at certain times. So I'll usually try and do, if we have three key sets, I'll do them on a Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. If I have two key sets, I'll maybe do them on a Tuesday and a Friday. So they're spread out across the week, the key sets. But there's certain things that are set in stone. For example, we'll always kick together twice a week, usually on a Wednesday morning and a Friday or a Saturday, depending on what's going on in terms of quality work. And then we will always do speed or tempo work together as a group twice a week. So we usually swim nine to 10 times. So at least four of the sessions across the week, the group is working together, even if within the session, there's certain different things going on, which is important, because the model is so bespoke that at times you can have nine athletes with nine different things going on, and you think, well, they've not actually spoke to each other for 3 or 4 days. So across the week, bringing them together at certain points and at similar points across every week, we'll do that with kicking and with pulling or with speed work.
You mentioned there using like the Albrecht test. Is that the only way you tend to measure kind of the effectiveness of a cycle, or do you use other methods to measure where the athletes are at as well?
There's a few things. I think the Albrecht test is used predominantly, and that gives us some objective information around what has happened and what we need to make happen in the future. Now, I've heard a lot of coaches talk about Albrecht, and you know, everybody is entitled to an opinion, and some people have mentioned that, how do you break barriers with historical data? But it's not historical data, because the data that you are using and analyzing is current and real time. So for me, if you go right, you might only ever go right for 6 to 12 weeks, depending on how long your mesocycle is. And if you go wrong, not that there is always a wrong, you might only go, you know, you might overreach somebody for 6 to 12 weeks. So if you're going in either direction, you might use only for a short period of time. I think when you come back to your question about measuring, we don't. I'm not a massive fan of using specific sets or specific tests other than the Albrecht model to measure the effectiveness of what we've done. We have a system in Ireland, and it's similar to the one that they'll use in Britain. Ours is called Kitman, where the swimmers will put their daily well-being into an app on their phone. I can get all the information, and then we collect meterage, RPE, rate of perceived exertion, and then we'll also create, and that creates a graph for us, and we can see across training weeks whether we've overreached them compared to maybe the week before, or we've underreached them. So that's more around how we measure the effectiveness than it is of so-and-so improved 650s compared to last week. Because I think when you're comparing week on week, as you go through a mesocycle, someone is potentially going to be more tired anyway. So effectiveness could be actually maintaining training quality rather than improving training quality. So it's difficult for us to measure, in my opinion. But I think the coach's eye is the king of that. And you'll know the effectiveness through what you're seeing and what they're reporting via their database Kitman.
So I just as you were going through there, I just thought of a nice little follow-up. You mentioned at the start of the interview, you mentioned the fact that you just love being on poolside, and that even if you weren't doing the job you're doing now, you'd be in club coaching somewhere. If you were going to run kind of an Albrecht style model in a club environment, obviously without the budget to do all the testing, how would you go about kind of going through that process you just identified there?
I think you could follow the principles of the model. I think there's, traditionally with Albrecht, and again, it is very individual, but you tend to do 2 key weeks and then you have a regen week, or some people do 3 key weeks and 2 regen weeks. And that tends to be with seniors, the pattern that we follow. Now, you can follow a very similar principle with age group swimmers. So rather than, going 5, 6, 7, 8 weeks in a row and then throwing 3 or 4 days of recovery, and you could force recovery, which is what the model in intensive purposes is and does, but there are certain things that you can do, and we've all done and we all do when we were age group coaches, which is, for example, when I was in Dumfries, we would have an aerobic check. Our aerobic check would usually be based around straight swims, long swims, at sub-maximal effort, taking heart rate and RPE. And then on the flip side of it, you can measure anaerobic capacity just by doing very simple things like asking swimmers to change speed or change pace. And you'll be able to, with your coach's intuition, not absolutely scientifically measure their anaerobic capacity, but you'll be able to see whether they have an ability to change pace or whether they don't. And what you find is usually the swimmers that can change pace really quite well suggest they've got a stronger anaerobic capacity than a weaker one. But it's not always the case, and it's not exact science. But you would, that's the way that we, or I, sorry, I would do it if I was to move back into club coaching.
So moving on now, I want to speak about kind of technical models, technical improvements. Obviously, as you mentioned there, you work particularly with senior athletes, and you have done for quite some time. What's your process for kind of analysing and changing technique within a senior athlete? Because, as an age group coach, it's pretty simple. You see something, and with age groupers, I think it can be an easier process to change in some technique. Whereas how do you go about that with senior athletes?
Something that's probably evolved specifically over the last 2 or 3 years for me since I've been in Ireland. I think I spent a lot of time when I was in Stirling analysing, watching swims, then delivering the information to the athlete on what I think they needed to do potentially from a technical perspective. And that works really well, and it's effective. But one thing we've done certainly the last 2 years in Dublin is we, from a coach's eye and perspective, we do a lot of analysis through the videos of them racing, through having the underwater cameras in the pool and training, or just very quick snippets of video analysis, and that's what we will use as a coaching team to discuss maybe where someone needs to be and what they need to do. And I think it becomes bigger than that when they're at senior level, because we're fortunate where we can bring a physio into that conversation, an S&C coach into that conversation, as well as a physiologist. And for me, that's where the kind of the nuts and the bolts get ironed out from a coaching team of where we need to be, because you might think X someone needs to do something when they're in the extension point on their freestyle, but actually the physio might be telling you they can't get in that position. So you could spend 3 or 4 months trying to get them to do it, whereas the fact of the matter is, until they improve something on land with the physio, it's not going to happen. So I think that's point one. The second thing we've done in the last 2 years, which I think has been really effective, is we, on a Thursday night or a Tuesday night, we have PA come down to the pool, and they film the swimmers at not sub-maximal, at quite strong paces. And the swimmers hop out on an individual basis. They watch their video 2 or 3 times over. They then get back in and they do it again. And we don't do it with any coach to swimmer conversation or interaction. We let them have a look at what they're doing. We let them see where they need to make a change. And then we have a conversation post-session around what they did and whether it was better or whether it was worse via the video. And I think the key thing for me when working with the seniors is getting their buy-in, and they have to believe what they're going to change is going to make them quicker. Whereas if you suggest it, but they don't believe what you're saying is what's best, you create conflict. And before you know it, you're at loggerheads over something that maybe actually it wasn't worth being in that position over. So we give the athletes a lot of autonomy with that side of things. And then once they realize they maybe need to make a change, we'll interject with our perspective.
So you mentioned there about obviously the process of staying in with the technical analysis. How important is it for you as a coach of swimmers that operate at that top level, that you stay on top of, you know, technical changes that are going on? You've got your finger on the pulse with any kind of bad habits or regressions or progressions that come in with the athletes?
Look, I think when it comes down to senior swimming, it's the small, finite detail that's going to make the difference between winning and losing, or making a final and not making a final. Everybody at that level is of such a high quality that it's the small details that are going to make the difference around stroke efficiency and maintaining rate, maintaining counts. And just briefly on that, one thing that we've done this year, which might be slightly untraditional, is we've moved away from doing skill work where we're focusing solely on, you know, giving them aids like fins and paddles so they can assist their body position. We've done a lot of ours with resistance. So we use a tether for them to create, it forces them to create feel, it forces them to pull in the correct pattern. If they're slipping water or they're rushing their stroke, they can feel it on the tether. And we've found that it's made a huge difference. And it's primarily what we do when we're doing skill work now. We'll do 80 to 90% of it on a tether, resisted, so that they can just ensure that at all times they've got maximum feel.
Cool. So I guess you spoke earlier in that kind of question, the question just before, about how you now use your strength and conditioning coaches, your physios as part of that technical process. I noticed on your Twitter once, I think you posted a reflection you'd done of a cycle, and you spoke about that there was really good synergy between what they were doing in the pool and what they were doing in the gym. What did you mean by kind of the synergy? In your experience, what types of work tend to fit well together from the gym into the pool?
I think that comes down to specifics of where the athlete is and what they need in terms of from a pool and a gym perspective. And, you know, I'm very, very fortunate to work with a really, really knowledgeable, enthusiastic and brilliant guy called Paul Talty, from a gym perspective. And he's very much on board. And, you know, we both take the outlook that first and foremost, they're swimmers, they're not gymmers. So they're swimmers that gym, they're not gymmers that swim.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's periods in the season where I'll say, Paul, it's over to you. and you get what you need. How many weeks do you need it? And what's it going to look like? And I will not base the pool around you, but I'll ensure that I'm not working them too hard, and then you're getting, you know, you're not working them too hard in the gym. Because for me, it's about time and productivity. And if they're doing something in the pool that doesn't support what they're doing in the gym, or vice versa, then you're going to be more susceptible to illness, to injury, to athletes breaking down. Or to be honest with you, senior athletes just getting frustrated about why they don't understand a certain block. So, for example, at the moment, for this next 6 weeks, starting last week, they're on a specific strength block in the gym, and it'll be the last one before the trials. So Paul has 6 weeks where they're doing 3 gym sessions a week, focused on strength and specific needs. And in the pool, things are specific from a physiological perspective, but the intensity is probably not quite at that top echelons of where we're going to be come February and March. And I've decided that I'll back off in the pool a little bit so that he can make his adaptations in the gym. Then come middle of February, we'll switch that round. The athletes will go to somewhere between 1.5 and 2 gym sessions a week. The pool will stay at 8 or 9 or 9 or 10, and the intensity will shift from the and focus from the gym to the pool. So it's just making sure that you're not overreaching them from both perspectives is key. And you know, if you take some of these athletes that are 26 and 27, they've done a lot of training over the years.
Yeah.
And, you know, we always discuss things like how strong is strong enough, you know, to break a world record or to swim a best time. And, you know, I think a lot of the time we spend too much of our productivity doing things that maybe don't necessarily need to be done. So it's like, well, do we make a strength a super strength? Is that the focus this block? Or do we make some of our weaker points stronger? You know, so I don't believe you can always do those together. So are we trying to make a strength a super strength, or are we trying to make a weaker point a stronger point? You know, so it's about just creating that synergy between the two, so that when it comes down to the gym coach is getting what they need to be able to give me what I need come the next block when we need them to be fast, or we need them to be, you know, training in a specific zone.
Have you ever come across kind of situations where perhaps like you've given that the strength coach time to do something in the gym, and you said, okay, now it's time to switch back to a bit more focus on what we're doing in the pool? Have you ever found that in that kind of crossover period, there's a tendency for maybe the athlete to not be quite ready to be pushed in the pool just yet if they're still adapting to something that's happening in the gym? Or is there usually, do you usually know exactly what's going on when, and when is the right time to do that?
Yeah, I would say probably with senior swimmers now, I can only speak about the current crop that I have. I would say that's very much that's dictated by stroke and then by strength. So I find the ones that are form swimmers, and specifically probably on breaststroke and fly, when they're in a strength block, they're in the pool, their distance per stroke suffers a little bit, and their power per stroke, if you like, suffers a little bit. And then when we go to switch over, like you've just said there, it might take 1 or 2 more weeks for them. It's not a hole they're in, but to make that adaptation. Whereas yeah. I find with the freestylers and the backstrokers, the synergy is a little bit more seamless, or the transition's a little bit more seamless. So I found with the fly and the breaststroke, we just have to make that gym block a little bit shorter at times and a little bit more intense, and then give them that little window when we're transferring between the two. Almost as a little bit of respite for them to just get their feel back in their legs, make sure they're not so heavy, and make sure that they're getting their DPS back in the pool, which is obviously critical on both of those strokes. So I found that it is specific to an individual, but it's more specific to stroke, I would say, when you get to, and because you naturally find that the flyers and the breaststrokers tend to be stronger, not in all cases, but certainly in the athletes we have now, like the two breaststrokers I have are, from a lower limb perspective, very strong. And we find that when they're transferring from a heavy gym block to a pool block, it'll be somewhere between 2 and 4 weeks for them to get some good distance per stroke back in their legs. Now, their upper body doesn't suffer, but their lower body really suffers. And that's something that we take into consideration when they're tapering, that obviously the breaststrokers at times will come off all sorts of leg dominant work in the gym, somewhere between 14 and 23 or 24 days before the race, whereas the freestylers and the backstrokers might be much closer than that.
So I want to speak now a little bit about obviously the ISL that ran through November. Obviously you had a few swimmers from your group that race out there. What was it like to kind of have swimmers out there training and racing away from kind of the environment you've been in at the National Centre?
Yeah. The two athletes that I have, you know, they're in their mid-20s. They're seasoned veterans of the sport, and you know, the opportunity to go and be part of something that's just going to grow and grow and is so exciting for the future of swimming from a coaching and swimming perspective was just something that I think they had to grasp with two hands. And you know, I gave them some very simple messages, and it was go out there and work with the coach that you've been assigned. Do whatever work they're doing. Do whatever work the group that you're in is doing. Learn, adapt, you know, take advantage of being around world-class athletes every which way you turn. And if you need anything, contact me. And I know that sounds very blasé, but that was pretty much how I left it. I thought, you know, if they're in Hungary and I'm in Dublin, and I can't really do too much to impact on what they're doing on a daily basis. So entrusting the people that are coaching them, and you know, obviously all the coaches that were there are of such a high caliber that why not use it as an opportunity to learn? And you know, that was something I spoke about specifically with Dara, who was away with Mel Marshall and Stephen Tigg, and I'd said, you know, just learn from the coaches and learn from the athletes, and you know, do anything and do it willingly, whatever they ask you to do. And the same with Shane. And you know, I think as long as they know that I was at the end of the phone if they ever needed anything, not that they ever do. And that's how we left it. And you know, I think that's how it has to be with seniors. I mean, why would you send them away with such a restrictive plan that, you know, they can't be part of a group, they can't interact, they can't get to know a coach or work with a coach. And you know, I think that's something that we have to look at from a coaching perspective with our own insecurities. If you're sending an athlete away with such a bespoke plan and not entrusting the coaches that are there, then probably that's more of us that's insecure than it is the athlete.
Yeah. So in terms of that, sort of, they're out there for like, was it 6 weeks in the end?
I think so, yeah, 6 weeks.
How much kind of input did you get into kind of the programs that they were doing out there? Did you have regular communication with the coaches, or was it kind of they've gone and you just left them to it after that?
Yeah, like I touched base with the coaches before they left and said, look, it's over to you. I'm not going to set them a program. I'm not going to set them a plan. You know, I trust your coach's intuition. I trust your plan. You know, it's a blank slate. For me, that's how it had to be, because, you know, if I'd planned something on a Friday for one of the boys and they were looking a bit fatigued, you know, but then I'd forced them to do it, it might have created conflict. So for me, it was about the coaches having complete control over what the boys were doing, but also the boys having control over what they were doing and acting and behaving like senior athletes. And, you know, I was in contact with the athletes after they raced, and that was more so for them to say, did you watch? What did you think? Is there anything I need to do? And even the feedback there was just enjoy it, keep going, and have a look at the video and listen to what the coaches are telling you, you know, because those guys out there, you know, there was two or three coaches in each team, 30 odd swimmers, are extremely busy. So, you know, I think when you're a professional athlete, if they don't know what they're doing at this stage, then certainly we haven't done a good job by them.
No, of course. Yeah. I think it always comes back to that line of, you know, the best coaches make themselves redundant over time, and you get,
yeah, absolutely.
They can be self-sufficient. So I just want to kind of sum up the podcast, sum up this episode today. I'm asking you for your top three points or tips for working with senior athletes.
Yeah, so this is the only thing I had to write something down on, and I thought I need to think about this question. So my first point is treat them as people. They're not robots, senior athletes. And I always use this phrase, they're human beings, not human doings. So treat them as people, get to know them as people, not just as athletes. And, you know, that helps to create a relationship that's positive, and that will ultimately result in hopefully success. So that's point one. Point two is listen. You know, they know their bodies, their experience. They have a lot of knowledge. They've got a lot of stories and highlights and lowlights that they've been through their swimming career and potentially their personal career. So listen to what they have to say, because quite often their input is valuable. And remember most importantly, they can have problems. Like I did say in the previous point, they're not robots, but just take time to listen to them. You know, so I think I was on a Zoom call in that lockdown, and someone said, you have 2 ears and one mouth. So, you know, you should be listening twice as much as you're talking. So I thought that was a very valid point. And my third point is that, for me, it has to be athlete-driven. It has to be an athlete-driven environment. There's no point in the coach driving the program. For me, we're here to help facilitate their goals and their ambition, but they've got to ultimately drive it. That gives them responsibility, gives them a little bit of autonomy. However, there are non-negotiables, you know, like we need to do 6 sessions this week or 9 sessions or whatever it might be. But for me, the athlete has to drive the program. The coach might lead it, but, you know, we are, myself, along with a physio, or S&C coach, nutritionist, we facilitate the athlete's needs. And that is very much to help them achieve their goals. So that would be my 3 points.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Ben. And Ben, thanks for your time today. I appreciate taking time out of the day to come and speak to us. And, you know, I certainly picked up a lot for those points. I'm sure the listeners did too. Listeners, thank you very much for tuning in. I'm trying to take this opportunity to point you towards our social media handles. So we're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at The Poolside Pass. And of course, our website, www.poolsidepass.com. Until next time, take care. It's goodbye from me and Ben. Bye.
Thank you.